been at this for as long as we've been at this, you know, it's easy to wear a certain cloak of comfort or a familiar refrain about ourselves. And occasionally it's good to have that cloak and that refrain challenged. Now, if we get too comfortable, well, getting comfortable could possibly appear as progress along the path, you know? And why shouldn't it for a little while, you know, 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there, but, you know, it's easy to become agreeable in contrast to the calamity of going deeper. So,
pain annihilation or backing off.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, sometimes we can use colorful or, you know, dramatic language. You know, and that evocation can be useful, if not entertaining. I mean, but what if it's much lighter than we have, you know, made things out to be because of the apparent catharses that we have, you know, read about vicariously and voyeuristically? Here's present experience. That's always the case. Regardless of the interest or the boredom or the aspiration or the recalcitrance or the crisis or the stoned sanguinity of it all, it's okay. And the miraculous capacity to frame what we call our lives and then build superstructures of identity, which include, of course, craving and aversion and stories told, that happens just perfectly spontaneously. And without noticing it, we claim, I thought, or I felt, or I experienced, or I'm in search of, or these are the various reasons why I've made progress or might fail to make progress. And it's that very, you could say, you know, miracle of on-demand apparition that can appear to obscure the simplicity of one's already present and already prescient, call it liberation. It's like, sure, yeah, the eye or sense, I mean, there's certainly a strong felt sense. We can't deny there's felt sense. I mean, and that'll knock our socks off, really. You know, if you go simply into felt sense, it's like, oh my God. In a way, you could say we mediate felt sense and the bliss of felt sense by turning our attention to the imagination of the eye, maybe you could say to keep a lid on it, right? To appear to function. Yeah, and then that reflex becomes, well, it's a habit. The eye becomes a habit. And we imagine then that this eye that's been constructed through really no effort of our own is now an insurmountable obscuration or an insurmountable obstacle for what my heart might really desire, which is some other imagination. And so we loop in divine aspiration, which we don't really understand because our sense of divine aspiration is always vicarious and voyeuristic through the things we've read or experiences we've had or the demonstrative, you know, exhortations of anyone that we've encountered. So we're really not sure what it is that we want, though we might believe we think or know what it is that we want, but we really, really don't know what it is that we want, if we want anything at all. So we convince ourselves through tapestry and layers of attraction and aversion, you know, as Buddha was clear to point out. And this pours out of us improvisationally, impersonally, and involuntarily. And that, you could say, is the, you know, the looming gigantism of I, which is a total fallacy. The whole thing is complete fallacy. So we confuse the present, you know, pressure of felt sense and what we call the sense windows and the ability to have consternation accompanying that all. That congeals in a, you know, a witch's brew of I. And now I've got a million stories to tell about everything as concerns enlightenment or not enlightenment, or of course any other topic that might, you know, be of interest. And we think that, you know, through our
the process feelings in my case.
Okay. So I mean everyone, you know, has their unique, right?
I'm a bad case.
Yeah. A lot of us are bad cases. Yeah. There's no question about it. Yeah, and sometimes what might appear to be a poor poker hand can be advantageous in that one is motivated to look more deeply, more sincerely, in a more nuanced fashion, to unwind the misery of myself.
Yeah.
if I'm, you know, light on my feet, you know, I might not have read I Am That 10 times. So it's really
be here now about 8 times.
There you go. Be here now 8 times. It's kind of funny. It's like Eckhart Tolle putting out a calendar. How can you read be here now 8 times?
No, maybe 4 or 5. It was a lot of times.
Well, sure, it's a lot of times. Yeah, because the you know, the poetry and the soma that's found in oneself through the vehicle of reading the book and then elaborating on whoever Neem Karoli Baba may have been, or Ram Dass, or, you know, other characters in that, you know, pantheon of weirdos, LSD, you know, so it's a vehicle of entertainment. I mean, it's really not that much different from getting a rush watching Gilligan Island reruns. But it feels, you know, spiritual perhaps because it's lofty. It's not just Ginger, Marianne, and the professor. You know, it's exotic.
It's powerful.
Yeah, absolutely.
You feel it in your body as opposed to just,
yeah.
Yeah. And a funny thing happened today. I had a session with a therapist. I said, she basically ended by saying, I know you know all this, but you got to process your feelings and that. She's very powerful. She comes out with that now.
Yeah.
So the next day I go into my office. And I've seen this now. This is earlier today I went to my office.
Yeah.
I've seen this now and then, but never quite this much at one time.
Yeah.
What sometimes happens in my case is that something in reality will alter itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I go into the room. I have these effigies and this mantelpiece on the far side of the room, all the deities.
Oh, far out, yeah.
Kind of like Freud's collection, but you know, he had a collection of of all these effigies.
Young head sand painting.
Right. So I have all these effigies, and one of them is the crucifix.
Sure.
That crucifix was on my desk, and a lot of the other effigies on the mantelpiece were rearranged.
Oh.
The guru's picture was obscured.
Uh-huh.
The chairs were rearranged.
Nice.
Who would have come here to do this?
Yeah, sure.
Nobody. Especially yeah. people in this place that are very low-key. So
right, yeah. In other words, not even for fun or practical joke.
Could I have hallucinated myself having done this?
Sure.
No, yeah. That's not true either. Reality. It's like whenever I go through something like that.
Yeah.
Something that says God's watching. God's got you in his sights. Kind of.
Kind of.
A reminder.
Yeah. This is
dreams I have. All the dreams I have, very acute. I went through this phase of lucid dreaming some time ago.
Sure.
It's like spiritual bypass, avoiding personal issues.
Well, yeah. I mean, even attending to personal issues could be a spiritual bypass. I mean, who's to say what the line is from, you know, here to there? Especially if there's no here and there's no there. There's just a streaming nature of apparition. And then the karmic vibration, which is the way one experiences the streaming nature of apparition. There's no here, there's no there. A very difficult dualism, you know, or dichotomy to crack is, you know, myself and God. Myself as the pawn, or myself as the extrusion. Myself as the creature that experiences shit between the bookends of birth and death, and somebody else, someone else, something else. Yeah, that's just not the case. But it's easy for us, the whole species, you know, it's like, what's the primary shock? Forget about original sin. The primary shock is like, fuck, I didn't do this. I don't remember doing this. Something, someone else did this, and I'm calling whatever or whomever that was God. And now I got a partner. Very hard to snap out of that. But it's understandable, you know, as a facet of conformist reality to imagine that there's something or someone other than you that did this because you sure as shit didn't. And now you've got, you know, a partner and a lifelong of calamitous codependency. Then everyone is suffering from this, more or less, to greater and lesser degree. Are we prepared? And it's okay if we're not, of course. Are we prepared to see or discover what it might feel like to be sovereign, autonomous, no longer suffering from the imagination, though it may be useful for the bhakta for a time, to worship something other? And do I get frightened because of the long years of devotion to this otherness? Do I become frightened were I to even remotely consider the possibility of turning my back on that codependency? Yeah. Processing stuff, which is fine. I mean, you know, tension arises in the system, whether through story or physicality, somaticism, emotionality, you know, all kinds of events trigger apprehension, insecurity, right? So why not process or discharge that irritability in as constructive a manner as we can? Talking to a therapist, talking to a friend, journaling, doing Byron Katie JYNs, listening to Joan Klein, you know, doing LSD and having visions of Neem Karoli Baba. you know, it's like fantastic. The challenge is the sense of self, the sense of individuation, the sense of privatization that follows us around, like, well, you know, a mangy dog.
I remember something. Apparently, I think Bart Marshall said, Richard Rose said, was if you can damage the mind-body system significantly and not affect the possibility of this unfolding to take place.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, there are guys in mental hospitals who are there. And the fact that they might be unbalanced and seeing a little bit odd in their behavior is that's a purely mechanical thing associated with their brain.
Yeah.
I suppose.
Well, Richard Rose himself, you know, suffered from dementia, right? And those people that were close enough to him, yeah. Alzheimer's, people that were close enough to him that sought his counsel or loved him and, you know, sought his company during that period, you know, many of them were understandably kind of confused or brokenhearted. And that the, you know, the bold person that Rose was became a fraction, right, of himself. And so it was maybe challenging to decipher or pick up whatever remnants of realization, you know, might have been present or emanating from him. John Klein, the same thing. It gets very unusual when we associate what we imagine realization to be with the meat. Or the brain, or the amygdala, or the neocortex. It gets very, very tricky in there. And yeah, if you damage, you know, the brainstem or the chemistry, it's impossible to discern whether the meat is enjoying the fruits of liberation or not any longer, because it's just not, you know, functioning in a resonant manner. And it's similar to having this lifelong partner called God that we are, you know, dependent on the corporeal nature of what we think experience is, and whether the body or the mind or the emotions are either contributing to our ease of being or our obscurations. I mean, if you go to Buddhism or Hinduism or 1,000 other places, they'll all tell you that you're a, you know, sinful, suffering, aversive loser, and try the Eightfold Path. Try the Four Questions and the Turnaround. Try, you know, Nirmanakaya. Try this, try that. You know, sit Vipassana with Joe Goldstein. Okay, but the dependency on these hobbies, you could say, interferes with the presence of nobody and nothing at all. It's the very anticipation of having or hoping to have, let's just say, a liberated experience, which ensures that you will never have the experience.
I think there's somewhere you have to go. There's something you have to achieve.
And it blows up, you can see, you know, very, very quickly. I mean, the slightest hint of subjectification or objectification blows the entire universe into, you know, appearance faster than you can say boo. Now you've got God as a partner. Enlightenment is something other and something else, and then everything that you need to do and not to do to improve your chances of something which is already the case. And so we remain, you know, stupefied by our own imaginations, good evening, for the long haul. If we're turning to experience as the arbiter of realization, we're toast. Because the moment you turn to experience as the arbiter of realization, who's present? You, body, mind, memory, experience, consciousness, all of this shit is present. And then we're trying to derive or squeeze soma, right, from an absolutely dehydrated lemon. It won't work. It can't work. The anticipation itself is, you know, the springing forth of what could be referred to as duality. How could this feel? How might this be if it were not accompanied by anticipation, memory, self-accusation, either in a pleasant or unpleasant way? Well, here it is. See, but we keep holding out. Well, it should feel like this, or it should look like that, or maybe I should be walking on water or healing the sick or have a total knowledge of all my past lives. Or I should be able to sit, you know, in a rigor mortis condition under some kind of samadhi for some length of time and be unperturbed by physical pain and, you know, da 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 da. So we have these incredible barrage of ideas, symptoms that we hope to demonstrate or experience to give us proof of life, proof of something. And that's, you guys, like, fuck, that's not going to work. This is apparitional. And as long as we turn to its apparitional nature, its apparitional demonstration as subject and object, consciousness and conscious contact, we are swept away like Ulysses rowers, or like Ulysses while the rowers had the cotton or the wax in their ears, right? Ulysses was just like agony as the sirens sang. Agony, had to go to the rocks. Had to go to the rocks, like us. But the rowers were like, just keep fucking rowing, Johnny. Just row. Don't hear a thing. It's the same thing.
Where do the rowers come into that analogy? I don't quite follow.
The rowers in this case were the realized guys.
Okay.
Hey, let's just keep rowing. See, there was no problem for the rowers. Ulysses was in agony. As he and wisely lashed to the mast so that no one would listen to his orders, because he would have driven them right into the rocks, as the sirens would have wished. So here is this, here's the sirens. This is it, this is the sirens. We are Ulysses. As long as we are subject, object, and individuated, we are suffering the agony of Ulysses. Realization, you could say, go rower. No agony. Let the fucking sirens sing. But the agony is gone because there's nothing other than you. There's nothing other than this. The miraculous presentation of individuation and therefore the apparency of separation is quiesced. And here it is. There's no steps anyone need take. Because there's no point A and there's no point B. Point A and point B is a hell realm. That's the sirens. That's the agony of Ulysses. Here we are. Everyone and everything can just fuck off. There is no fulfillment. Wouldn't it be nice, even if for a moment or two, to be free from the myth of fulfillment? Then where are you going? Who's got the big news? What guru do we need to turn to next to find out about shit?
I read a great passage yesterday from this guy named Andrew Hall. I think it was big news. Loose dream, wrote this book called Dream Yoga. It's kind of the last
word
in the system.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
All the Tibetan texts about it.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And again, I'd never heard this before. I must confess, having taught Buddhism, Asian religions, you devote 3 or 4 weeks of the tradition. I never ran into this.
Uh-huh.
There are 8 worldly preoccupations.
Good.
There are 4 pairs: pain,
yeah,
pleasure,
yeah,
pain, shame,
right,
gain, loss,
yeah,
and more.
Make it up.
Poverty and wealth.
Good, that's a good one. Go poverty and wealth.
There's a gain, loss, and there's, I don't remember what it's here.
Happiness, sadness.
But they'll run. They'll run.
Yeah.
Shame. Shame, fame. Blame. Fame.
Huh.
No, shame, fame, blame, approval. I get the mix up, but there are 8 of them. There's a brilliant formulation.
Yeah.
Of human condition.
Sure. Why not?
What was his remedy? Go to sleep and dream?
His remedy was, this notion of dreaming, you know, becoming more and more lucid in your dreams. And then, yoga nidra is the art of basically going into trance and taking yourself deeper without falling asleep.
Yeah.
Falling asleep without falling asleep and going all the way to the core.
Yeah. Core of what? There is no core. There's no core.
Does that contrast with everything else?
There's no contrast. There's just the siren song. This is the siren song. This is the agony of having the privilege to hear the siren song. If you want to remedy the siren song, you will remain under its spell for the long haul. You see, let this be itself, rather than take it on as a mantle of one's birth or one's imagination or one's so-called experience. Leave it alone. So-called one's dharma, one's karma. Just leave it alone. See, the moment you touch this, guess what? It touches you back. Because its nature is generosity. If you touch it, it touches you back. But it touches you back with such an incomprehensible volume of potentiate and nuance that you are obliterated,
bamboozled,
blown away with the rich tapestry of everything that this can appear to be. Then, of course, we're going to find suffering just like we're going to find not suffering. So we might be attracted toward not suffering and averse to suffering. And it's like now you're toast, you know. You're a slab of knockwurst on a, you know, suffering, non-suffering sandwich. Just leave it alone. It doesn't require intervention. Leave it alone. Here it is. Sirens. Everything's fucked. Cool.
Easy to get the idea that one of the 2 most powerful drives of all, the most powerful natural desires of all, are insoluble, if you will. But I suppose they're not. Sexuality.
Hey, you know, all kinds of shit shows up in the siren song. The biological imperative. I mean, whether it's sexuality, what if it's mitochondrial? You know, sex is like way downstream of mitochondrial imperative. The mitochondria is like, you better give me some fucking glucose or I'm going to kick your ass. In other words, I will shut your fucking respiratory system down if you don't give me some fucking glucose. Sex is way downstream of that. We call this the body, B-O-D-Y.
I never quite thought of that. I see that there's a core. All right.
We call this B-O-D-Y, right? Simple, body. Maybe my body. Okay, M-Y-B-O-D-Y. But what is it really? It's unfathomable. It's infinity. Whether you're looking at how many cells there are, how many functions are being carried out by those cells, what the constellation of actual experience is, whether through the sense windows or the biologic or the subbiologic, or where the photonic meets the chemical, the crystalline, sonorous, you know, hum of the bones. I mean, you could spend 25 lifetimes and more just delving into the miracle of what we call M-Y-B-O-D-Y. But this we completely dismiss out of boredom or stupidity or insensitivity. And then we run around going to therapists and psychics and ascended masters and anyone else that we can find to help us with the triviality of our problems. Like, fuck the miracle, I'm suffering. We're bananas. We're children. One way of thousands that the mind, let's say, confuses itself or us as the collateral damage is to come up with hierarchical notions, like a core.
I like the idea that Republicans are in some way systematically, ethically inferior to Democrats.
Well, that's true. But it can also be a blip. Here's present experience. Do you really need to do anything with it? About it? Do you really need to take yourself on the road to higher consciousness? And if you do, there's a whole bunch of Zendos that are ready to take your contribution.
Just trying to hit those rocks.
I'm just heading for the rocks.
Just take a hit of those crack rocks, I mean.
And that's it. Crack rocks. Same thing. You see how the urgency of self arises from what exactly? Nobody fucking knows. We might say, oh, well, the urgency of, you know, it's like, oh, well, the Four Noble Truths, you know, like life is unsatisfactory and unsatisfactoriness is caused by, right? Attraction and aversion, and attraction and aversion can be broken. And the way to do that is by following with steadfast earnestness the Eightfold Path. This is absurd. It's like, that's for children. It's for children. It's a children's story. It's something you would share with fourth graders or less.
I always said that about the Bible.
Same
thing. The Eastern stuff gives you the technical stuff right up front.
Well, it's more sophisticated. I mean, the Bible was just a bunch of weird frothing. But like, you can actually get some shit out of, you know, the Vedic and or the Taoist, right? Works that predated the Bible by some meaningful number of years. You know, of course, the Islamic thing kind of came, you know, a little later as a strange blend of Asian, Eastern, Indian Gnosticism and, you know, Middle Eastern passion. You know, hey, if it weren't for, the Cold War and the Atomic Age, you know, L. Ron Hubbard might not have gotten the kind of purchase that he got to create Scientology and Dianetics and the fucking Sea Org.
I don't know. I think regardless of his environment, he could have spun a good enough story up and people would have believed that.
He was good. So here's this. Da-ba-boop-ba-ba, biddly-bit-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n-n things that you, not just you, but any of us, all of us, everyone has made of it was categorically untrue. It's partial. then it just goes. Then enlightenment, or one's idea of enlightenment, stops, you know, with kudos to the talking heads, stops making sense. Or start making sense, whatever it was. You see, you can only get wound up in the prideful, my hands up, prideful imagination of everything that I think I have collected, you know, over the course of some small number of years. You can only get caught up if you believe it, if you define yourself by it. If you've compartmentalized all of these magnificent, entertaining, cathartic teachings, and then placed yourself into some kind of context or relationship to them. But the teachings are trivial, and so is the imagination of yourself. It's absolutely trivial. But we're prideful, so we'll use teachings and cathartic enterprises and meetings with remarkable men to buoy ourselves up and go on a fantastic adventure toward enlightenment. We may as well be, you know, grabbing a broomstick and chasing down a windmill. That's been done too. You see how quickly self-definition shows up as a go-to, as a default. End it. Not by effort, because there's really nothing to do about it. Oh, self-definition. Well, golly. But it has no impact. It doesn't land. It doesn't define you. There's no purchase. Now your mind, if we want to use that metaphor, is clear. Absolutely clear of implication.
First time was, I had read, I did my dissertation on Spinoza's ethics. Spinoza was, he was a monistic determinist, sort of contradiction in terms. He was, his definition of substance, that which is not made of anything that came before it.
Sweet.
It's self-existent.
Yep.
It's not made of anything that was there first.
Nice.
And it's just, I try to visualize that or feel it. It's one of those things that caused the mind to shift.
Oh, yes. Right.
Fear, you know.
Yeah. This is all just amygdala tickling in a metaphoric way of speaking.
No reference. It doesn't land anywhere.
That's right. It has no core. There is no reference. It doesn't land anywhere. You're free to enjoy or suffer this. And guess what? You don't care whether you're enjoying it or suffering from it. See, if there's a preference to enjoy it as contrasted with suffer from it, well, you're suffering from it. You see, because there's the creation of a sense of self, sense of time, sense of birth, sense of implication, sense of identification, conjuring, preference, reference, I am fucked. Like that. Instantaneously, with no effort on our part. And then we become all prideful of it, to the point of genocide.
It touches you back.
Careful, it will. And it touches you back with much more oomph than you touch it. Don't touch it. And it's not that there's some you know, premeditation or plot to keep you or anybody else under the influence of samsara. No, it touches you back, you could say, out of love, out of affection, out of, you know, spontaneous recognition. If you touch it, it touches you back. And it touches you back with this much pageantry, more than we can bear, more than we can stand, more than we can comprehend, instantaneously. We're the last to know. This is the alien. The alien touches you back. This is the alien. It's the dreaming alien. You touch it, it touches you back. It touches you back with so much generosity, so much profundity, so much incomprehensibility that we are basically shocked, you know, into self. See what it might feel like for that typical reflex to be, well, undermined or released or whatever. I mean, the words aren't important because it's really, you could say, more profound, more intimate than, you know, we could convey with language.
Doesn't land anywhere.
Just doesn't. No. Memory, whatever memory is, makes it appear as if this lands somewhere, as if this is about something. And if it's about something, well, it's certainly got to be about me, but it's not about anything. It's just dreaming. It's just freestyling. It's just freestyling. But here, where the collateral damage occurs, it's taken too seriously. It's taken too personally. We imagine that we're the product of something that came before, but we're not. And here it is. Wow. Exactly this. This is the top of the Himalaya. This is the fountain pouring out of Shiva's head. This is it. No need to be special. This is the fountain pouring out of Shiva's head. Why be special?
How could you be more special?
What could you possibly need? The profound sense of individuation really does sneak up on us and is nothing other than us, whatever us is. If this is truly the fountain pouring out of the top of Shiva's head, metaphorically, you know, or the acorn hat that the Buddha wears, we don't know what this is. If I don't know what it is, if I'm really, you could say, enjoying or cruising with present experience without knowledge, without presumption, without assertion, do I need to fix anything? Do I need to be enlightened as a complement or a contrast, as a remedy for my so-called suffering self? Nope. Rather than get someplace, the presumption of being anywhere just disappears. Then there's no place to go. Those people that are, you know, chomping at the bit for enlightenment, it's like, oh, you know, I'm sorry to hear that. I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah, you're still working on that. This just empties out from the bottom. Nothing happens to you. Nothing needs to.
I think I would explode if in the relative realm, if I'm right about this inner child that needs to express itself for the 10 years before I get here.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe hearing all this will sort of indirectly cause enough super deep understanding to start to make things straighten themselves out.
Yes. Yes, 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 and yes, and yes. Uh-huh. That's right. The awakening of mind, which is, let's say, saturation or bathing in referencelessness, will, of its own nature and accord, reorganize the kaleshic obscurations that that may still be lurking in one's psyche and attract and hold your attention as if they need to be dealt with. Yeah. Yeah, sitting, bathing in referencelessness ameliorates the chemistry and psychosis of restlessness.
Yeah, man, that one. Bathing in referencelessness. Got that much.
Cleanses the psychic palate. Without having to process content, because processing content is just dabbling in the apparitional nature of fantasy.
I can see why bodies and minds can change so much when this happens to people. You start to gain weight, lose weight. Your body shifts completely.
Things can happen. Here is this. Do you think it really cares about, you know, my interpretation of cathartic disappointments? No. Not to dismiss or belittle the all too many traumas that occur in the so-called world today across a palette of 7.4 billion souls as the thing heats up and the food chain starts to dwindle, right? Choking denial and fascism becomes the, new watchword of our faith. So, yeah, you know, I get that. I feel it like anybody else might. I would suggest it's not nearly as defining as we might imagine it to be. Even in the face of regrettable tragedy, which is happening all the time. Whether through gun violence, or mining, or smoking, or smelting, or burning vegetation, or hunting, or making, you know, palm oil. And right. Destroying the... we could go on and on, right? Yeah, I mean, we could finish a bottle of scotch and we won't be done talking about just how much shit we're in before we hit the bottom. All right. So it might turn out that a little, a little micro-dusting of referencelessness could come in handy. See if that, the trigger of processing your imagination through your imagination and the superimposition of place and time and implication and past and present and future, all of that stuff just arises apparitionally, the whole of it, including the body and my emotions and my mind and my history and everything that I regret or am angry or, you know, whatever about. It's all apparitional. So it's really a question of, not that it's really a question of anything, because it's not really a question of anything. If the present moment, were there one, is appearing in a, you know, manifested way, in an apparitional manner, and we're fucking with it, if we touch it, it touches us back. Now we need a lot of therapy. Everyone needs a lot of therapy, whether they're getting it or not. But, this is also nirvana. for the taking, for the asking. This is nirvana. Nirvana is not anything. That's what this is. It's not about anything.
Sometimes contemplating the question, another scary thing that occasionally happens to you, at odd moments of consideration, at some time my shoes or something, every so often the question, why is there something rather than nothing?
Yeah.
That will get me. Oh, shoot.
Sure.
It's gone.
Uh-huh. Ooh. Yeah.
Can't get over the impression I would just drop. I think my body would be blown. It'd be accelerating 1,000 miles an hour away from where it is right now.
That might be presently the case, and we're just not noticing it. So you might be thinking of it as, you know, in a material, right, demonstration of what would happen to cells or what would happen to the body. But the body is of the nature of imagination. So this, you know, flying apart at the speed of light is this. But it doesn't necessarily have to, you know, tear the body asunder. It needn't have any symptoms. You see what happens to us when we're holding out for preferred symptoms? We're in time again. We inhabit again as the creature, looking for symptoms, sniffing out symptoms, meditating and purifying and, you know, drinking beverages and doing whatever it is that we do so that we can tickle symptoms. Walking on, you know, fire. Take an ayahuasca. Come and do a talk or, you know, a salon like this one. It's very fun, curious. Let's just say to be relieved of symptoms, to not look or not count on the experiential field to be the arbiter of what condition you're in. Who gives a fuck? But it's not a rejection. It's just a seeing through. If I make no sense of this, if I don't interject myself, the imagination of myself, into present experience, well, it's completely novel. And I'm not looking to it for proof of anything. Happiness, realization, progress, satisfaction. Not dependent on it any longer. Nobody knows anything. Not because they've, you know, failed at their attempt. Perhaps more importantly, because there's nothing to know. This is just apparitionally appearing. Each moment is absolutely new and absolutely gone at the same time. Are we paying more attention to the refresh or the disappearance? The refresh or the disappearance? In our imagination, we think this is about something because it appears as if it's a field of continuity. But there's no continuity. It's just, fuck me, pure miracle. Is it new or is it gone? I don't know.
And no matter how sophisticated the system you try to understand it with, there's a total, absolute You can't try to think of a really subtle science or modern physics or anything. The difference between the most subtle analysis of particles or whatever and truth is just as vast as between a boxing match and truth.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah? Yeah. I mean, anything that is appearing phenomenally, you know, whether it's a hadron collider or, you know, an extra solar telescope, should we get there someday? It's just apparition reflecting upon itself.
Or a Moffitt shootout.
Sure, that's right. It's just apparition reflecting upon itself. Wow. No core, no destination, nothing missing, nothing need be added, nothing need be taken away, nothing derived, no explanation, no clever teaching, no integration, no enlightenment.
His name, anyway, that banjo player.
Uh-huh, the enlightened banjo player.
Funniest presentation I've ever heard. What's his name? Oh, God. He woke up driving his car. Looking through the leaves at the sun or something like that.
I could do it. You know, we celebratize others because we celebratize ourselves. We might crave or envy the so-called experience of others because we misunderstand our own nirvana. If attention goes to mind, it's going to find story. If attention turns toward whatever presence might be, it discovers texture. That texture mutates. Not that it actually mutates. You could say attention mutates.
You unlearn everything.
Yeah.
Grace happens through grace.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, everything happens through grace. You know, the suffering and the learning and the unlearning. The entire expression of, you know, phenomenality is grace itself, desire itself. Grace and desire are the same. Here they are. Here this is. There is nothing to unlearn because you've never actually learned anything. And any reference that you or anyone makes to artifacts of the past or artifacts of knowledge are just presently apparitionally appearing. There's no store of knowledge. This is acausal.
Book of Heaven. The Akashic Records up there.
Yep. What we're doing if we're doing anything with the, you know, blasphemous frivolity of these conversations, you could say it's just taking a water cannon to the reflex of believing anything. Granting ourselves, and you could say each other conversationally, to be free from reference. You know, most human conversation and interaction, right, is the ping pong match or a tennis match, right, of ideas and preferences and, you know, accusations and nudges and pushes and pulls and sometimes violence and sometimes, you know, not. It's not all that common that what we call human hanging out in a salon are friendly towards referencelessness. Maybe folks in a meditation hall, but that's just so contrived. You know, there's so much pressure in the meditation hall to play monkey see, monkey do with, you know, Guenka, with IMS, you know, with whatever, Patanjali.
Dungeon.
Yeah, fuck all that. This doesn't need us to ritualize it. Not necessary to ritualize this. Whether through the church or the mosque, you know, or the Wailing Wall. If we're looking at ourselves, you know, as a species, given an opportunity to discover transtemporal communion, that's not going to occur through ritualization. Because ritualization is dead, stupid, the past, prideful, authoritarian. Referencelessness is not. Referencelessness is alive, mirthful, strange, nourishing.
Nourishing.
Ritual is violence. Referencelessness is nourishing.
Overflows with effervescent joy.
Overflowing with effervescent joy, like a suppository. It's not glib. We can easily be glib. But referencelessness is not glib. And that's how, one way, that the samsaric tendencies, the kleshic tendencies, heal quite naturally without fussing, processing. Referencelessness heals the ritualistic nature of our own self-identity.
It takes it apart in a gradual and non-damaging way, I hope.
Yes. Yeah. And just like chutes and ladders, you know, sometimes, it, you know, things can happen in a rush. But that's all right. Mm-hmm. you could say, rather than being a holdout for the heroic gesture of some kind of enlightenment that may or may never come, well, instead of that, just hang out in referencelessness, you know, when and where you can. Much simpler. It's more direct, and it works. Can't. So you evaporate, not necessarily through catharsis, but through absolute simplicity.
All that old catharsis stuff might continue as part of the mechanics of your...
Yeah, what the hell? Yeah, we're not, not making prescriptions of any kind for what to do or not to do. This salon, you know, visited by few, generally. Well, it's, you know, shared referencelessness. You know, if it's ritualistic at all, that ritual would be, we're meeting at such and such a place and such a time, you're welcome to be there. After that, it's like, you know, there's no ritual. You can wear a funny hat if you want, but it's not required. And if, you know, any participant has whatever, something on their mind or, right, an insight or not an insight or what appears to be an obscuration or this or that, well, you know, in the company, in the chorus of mind, this kind of mindfulness, referencelessness, well, those, they just dissipate. Because nothing's resolved, nothing becomes anything.
This is what's been, the country's been going through this last, ever since Trump's campaign began. It's been a process of surrender. It's just stuff happening. This can't do anything about it, but even if I could, it's just stuff happening. But it's difficult to be, see all your golden calves that you love so much just get trashed.
Well, you know, sure, that happens at what we might call, you know, my spiritual golden calves or my relational golden calves or my political, right, aspirational, career, savings, health. You know, everything's at risk all the time without being at risk at all. Discovering a source of nourishment which is not dependent on circumstances and events can be, you know, useful. And that would be this.
And you don't become a robot.
No.
Oh,
if you're lucky. I mean, because there's no ritual here, or cosmology here, then, you know, we're not providing purchase to roboticize. Which is perhaps rare. And, you know, most folks are intimidated by referencelessness, intimidated by intimacy. This is remarkably intimate, though. No one has to say anything about just how weird they are to try to get, you know, vetted, validated. You know, your weird fucking humanity is really, you know, your business. But this is profoundly intimate because that's just the nature of referencelessness.
Doesn't even refer to the universe.
No.
It presupposes all universes.
It's acausal. Completely acausal. Yeah. The universe is a tapestry that appears at the pleasure of referencelessness. You are not the product of a universe. So with a certain kind of stillness, not imposed, you know, a certain quality of ease of being, you know, just a naturally effervescing relaxation, then the boundary conditions of birth and death and time and quality of life and, you know, financial or emotional security, all those things, that they're gone. We're gone. We're not defining ourselves or present experience by virtue of circumstances and events. Abiding is not abiding in anything, nor is there any one doing the abiding.
We keep grieving over things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Polar bears can swim about 20 miles between ice floes, but they can't swim 200 miles. They drown.
There is a lot of grieving to do. Nourished by presence, by referencelessness. What we refer to as mind loses its interest in the capacity to conjure. The thirst for nourishment, you could say, is still present. Let's call it mitochondrially, or even subtler still. But now, instead of being malnourished by the mind's capacity to conjure, one discovers nourishment through release of that habit. Presence is fecund.
Like you're
Yes, sir.
I can relate to it. I think of two things at the same time. It's a scene of Lawrence of Arabia where the guy's going out in the desert to rescue somebody.
Yeah.
And there's a pest, which is a short essay by Thomas Burke to the effect that, you know, you empty this dark hole of this boredom and nothing working.
We all know that well.
You paint yourself into a corner. I'm exhausting all the means that you would normally use to process feelings. I've been reduced to screaming in my car, Sufi qawwalis. At a certain point, that's not going to work either.
Well, it runs its course like anything. You know, the urgency for homeostasis, both biologically, emotionally, spiritually. What can you do? You respond to the urgency for homeostasis. And anything that, you know, needs to be, wants to be processed through whatever means, you know, catharsis in the car or yoga nidra or you name it, will run its course. I mean, after all, we are wild animals, aren't we?
Stuff.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, you've been at it a while. I have. Right?
In front of the right crowd. If you come to the first meeting, I want you to be quiet and only talk when we're participating on the Sargadatta process. Yeah, it's called daytime non-duality. For people who are retired, they're not working, you know. If he comes along,
pretty close to that,
he's close. Yeah, you can come.
The age group, but
yeah. We'll do a structured Nisargadatta discussion, allowing everybody to participate. Maybe just reading passages, go around the circle, that sort of thing. I don't know how it's going to work yet, but yeah, first meeting coming up in March 5th, Monday, 10 o'clock in the morning. Too many people I can cram into my office. The 5 people are some people. Well, sir, I am grateful for I promised the old lady I'd be home by 9 o'clock.
Thanks for making the journey here. Always appreciated. Good to see you.
Where's the hat?
Oh yeah. You don't want to leave.
It's scary. I'm telling you.
Scary is, man.
You're shitless.
Scary is good. Nothing to be afraid of here.
I started giggling uncontrollably. That's scary. Taxes.
Oh, it's just a piece of paper. Well, giggling uncontrollably might be a nice new reference point for all of that car wailing you were doing.
Oh my goodness.
Oh. Yeah.
We got some folks on Zoom. Oh, I gotta try that one video. Start getting more tech savvy. Yeah.
Thank you. Pebble Hill, thanks you.
I thought it was gonna go with the candle.
One day it will. It all will. Yeah. Oh, good. Thanks. Well, maybe we'll see you on March 5th. Is there like a Panera or something around there that?
No, there's a
group of people can hang out in and
sip
coffee.
There is a Papa's Pizza place about 3 blocks away. It was the best.
nothing like pizza for breakfast. So they open at 10 a.m.?
I think so, actually. But the idea of this is it'd be sort of structured, you know, panned outs and and go around the circle sort of thing, silent atmosphere, no disturbance, like with doors opening, cars going by or anything like that. Traditional notions about silence and, you know, present group meditation.
Well,
you're doing all that.
It's your meetup, man. You make it flow how you want.
Yeah, you gotta come. You can come, please come.
See if I can tolerate all that structure.
Yeah, although, yeah, I'm scared that you might not be able to tolerate the structure.
Yeah.
The first time, you not tolerating the structure wouldn't be too good. The other times, you'd be more than welcome to occasionally.
I don't want to usurp your high. Yeah, don't get too near the event horizon.
Event horizon.
Thank you, sir.
Get that.
All righty. Joy to the world.
Joy to the world.
You guys meet on Tuesday and Wednesdays?
Yes. Yeah, it's a nice warm night.
Yeah. See what else doing?
I think we just had a little blip. Blips happen. That tapestry just shows up like you willed it to show up. And even, let's say, holding my childhood or my, you know, parental relations or bonding or lack of bonding with my primary caretaker or my breastfeeding or my heredity or accountable or responsible for this miraculous tapestry that I call myself is like, I'm not so sure. I'm referencelessness, whatever it might be, as it, you know, matures in us, just cleanses the palate of all of these associations. We don't actually heal from the disappointments that we may have suffered. Referencelessness just makes them obsolete.
So I thought when you were talking about Krishnamurti last week or whenever, you're like, oh, he was still shy, and I'm like, oh man, if it didn't fucking help him, like, can't help. Like,
I mean, was like, you know, Ramana Maharshi, you know, psychiatrically, emotionally made whole by his 14-year-old enlightenment. I mean, who the fuck knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? You know, I mean, in Indian culture, orthodox, Hindu, misogynist, chauvinistic, devotional, Vedic culture, everyone's all fucked up. The whole thing is fucked up. I mean, what made, you know, Ramana, Nirsagadatta, Ramakrishna, who, you know, what? You know? They became whole somehow? I don't think so. I mean, they may have become ecstatic and Brahmanic, but it doesn't mean they were psychiatrically well put together. but the tapestry of who they may have been as persons, you know, depending on how their childhood went, became obsoleted by something else. You know, it happened to us too. Why not? I mean, I haven't made any progress as concerns my bullshit personality or my, you know, childhood wounding or any of those identities. The seriousness of it all has just become obsoleted by, well, perhaps more frequent nourishment with referencelessness. So the same sense of locality or identification that could link me to the disappointments of my past are like, well, it's not like they're gone, but there's less purchase. I don't want to go out on some limb and make some claim about, you know, being special, because I'm not. I mean, I'm as disappointing as the next human. Really. God. Fuck. Worse than most. The tenacity of the creature identification relaxes, melts away. So you have what you could say always been, what this always has been, improvisational novelty. And let's say we learn to feel more comfortable resting in that or responding from that or engaging from that perspective rather than all the things that I need to heal about my loathsome condition. Or somewhere in between. And, you know, it's not black and white. You know, mix it up. Why not? Is present unsatisfactoriness, can it really be, you know, etched or linked back to prior experience? It can appear so. Certainly can appear so. It might not be. We don't have to be pushed around by conscious contact. We don't have to make something of anything or everything and conjure up a context for what we would say is my condition or my experience. We don't really know what our condition or our experience is. But the neurosis that's capable of presuming that it can articulate what one's present condition and present experience is, well, that's the same neurosis that craves healing. It's like, well, after you've conjured this, you know, full-bodied sense of neurosis through just the pure power of imaginative prowess, now you want to heal it. Well, just don't do it in the first place. Don't manufacture the apparition and now busy yourself trying to heal it. Like, is it really the way that we imagine it to be or ourselves to be? And that's just a, you know, fantastical, you could say, orientation of, well, disparate symptoms all arising as present experience, and then some kind of familiar accusation is made that I am the product of X, Y, Z. And I'm not, you know, putting it down or suggesting that all therapists should, you know, become something else. I've benefited quite a number of times from the right therapist in the right moment to touch a place of, you know, vulnerability and convert a shadow into humor. To get what would you say, the, you know, the compassion of a witness, that releases the right internalization of profound emotion, and then it's just, it opens up, you know, like a gate. So yeah, there's a few therapists I have I'm indebted to that I probably didn't thank enough.
Maybe Beth should have went and been the one to thank them.
Yeah.
Probably for her benefit.
Yeah. It was so funny. I mean, all the stuff that led up to, you know, meeting with her and what small amount of maturity may have been present in me to, you know, to turn that into a fruitful encounter. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was nervous. I was like, you know, I just told her I'm no good. I've been no good for a long time, you know, and you're swell and I'm fucking damaged. She wouldn't have it. What was I going to do? I went with it. I couldn't put up that much of a fight for that long. She disarmed me. I'm telling you, it was that fucking Arizona sky. Yeah, southern Arizona sky. Something about being under that kind of space and that kind of canopy.
Oh, now I see the name of the group.
Yeah.
I never understood it.
Yeah. That's right. Night Sky Sangha. Get healed under a canopy of stars.
I've never been there except when I was really young.
It's awesome. It was very, very healing. It really was, especially coming out of, you know, Southern California, West L.A., Santa Monica, West L.A. I was fucking choking. Really choking. The mind, mind is not capable of satisfaction. We'd like to think, you know, the nature of my identity, the restless nature or remorseful, regretful, angry, codependent nature, you know, can somehow find a resting place of some kind. No, it's with the cessation of mind that the alchemy of nourishment appears. And that's, you know, one of the maddening, mirthful aspects of the yoga is that habitually we do a certain kind of grasping and orientation with what we call the mind, perhaps hoping to find, you know, a crumb of, well, peace, release, gratification. And you know, sometimes we find a nugget here and there. But the you can say the fireworks really begin, which are no fireworks at all when there's effortless cessation of mind. So the grasping reflex, the deriving reflex, the orienting reflex is just not operating, not functioning. And then this can be whatever it wants to be, you know, without our concern or intervention. But even any kind of characterization about anything that sounds, you know, behavioral or that's vectored around the presumption of, you know, being human doesn't touch it, doesn't do it, can't really portray it.
That woo, ba ba boo, boo boo boo, boo 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 boo. That's my stomach's call for dinner.
There you go. Oh yeah. Hey everyone, thanks for being with us this evening. We really enjoyed your company.